said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Steve Clements. He's the editor-at-large of The Hill, which is the United States' largest political media platform. Steve is a long-term friend of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. If INET had a most valuable player in terms of moderating, catalyzing, and helping us shape our conferences, Steve would certainly be nominated, and he would get my vote as the winner. Steve, thanks for joining me here today.
Rob, it's a real pleasure.
So we are talking at this juncture, September 2020. You and I have been talking for years about all kinds of things related to the intertwined nature of economics and politics. We have a rather flamboyant president right now, an election coming up. But let's step back a little bit. What are the maladies? What are the stress points? What are the injustices that you perceive which the arrival of the pandemic and the stress related to it have, which you might call added impetus to addressing or observing or rebelling against?
Well, I think one of the interesting things, Rob, is that the observations that I've had, that many people have had, that look at inequality in America, that look at health disparities, that look at the fact that there are winners and losers, and far more losers more recently in the kind of economic equation that America has had. INET's been studying, you know, these issues for years. What COVID has done is, you know, out of this horrible social experiment, we've seen that something like a mass pandemic has hit, disproportionately hitting communities of color, infection rates, mortality rates, disproportionately hitting those at the lower end of the socioeconomic class. And then economically, I tell you an example, I know a lot of people, as I'm sure you do, you know, who have, you know, decided to take their children and they kind of co-pod, which means they sort of live and exist together so that they limit others. And they hire, because they can afford it, tutors for their kids to come in and supplement what they're doing online. And it's just a screaming example of the fact that most in America can't do what we're seeing unfold around us. And I think what's really interesting to me, and going back to the original days of INET being formed with you, George Soros, so many others in there, and basically saying, you know, we live in a time of manic neoliberalism, manic globalization, and a disregard for what's happening at the microeconomic and micro reality of that, that many people share. Well, COVID and this pandemic we're in right now, and combined with this odd moment in trade and economic policy with Donald Trump, it has created both a major spotlight on the disparities that are baked in and that have been worsening. But I think there's an interesting opportunity because of those eras of, you know, what I would call, you know, Bill Clinton led, Tom Friedman, you know, cheered manic neoliberalism, and I don't mean to throw words around, but this notion that the micro level folks that were feeling the impact could be disregarded and shoved under a rug, that seems to have come undone. Now, I don't think it's been replaced by anything significant. We're at a moment of chaos and uncertainty when it comes to economic thinking, I think. And that's why I think INET is the oasis for that, potentially, in this moment. So I think we're seeing horrors out there, but I don't think people have the intellectual infrastructure that INET has, and it's just right for this time.
Steve, I would underscore that INET, which was formed in the aftermath of the dissatisfaction that George Soros, Rob Duggar, and I had with the TARP legislation, there was an insight at the lunch that we had where George said, I grew up in Hungary when the Nazis invaded and then the turmoil in our country and the rest of Europe. And when I look back in history, I trace the onset to the 1931 German and Austrian banking crisis. And his words were very succinct. He said, the loss of trust, the loss of confidence in finance, the loss of trust in expertise creates a void. And INET's job will be to fill that void. You talked about an oasis. I don't know if it's a cauldron or an oasis, but I do remember George seeing precisely the kind of role for INET to play that you underscored moments ago.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that at the time, you know, with the TARP legislation, the 2008-2009 financial crisis, and I think it's relevant to, you know, some of the characters that are running for office today, is that there was a fight among Barack Obama's team that included people like Gene Sperling and Austin Goolsbee, Tim Geithner, Larry Summers was a key advisor and player in this, with a man named Jared Bernstein. You know Jared very well. And Jared Bernstein was Joe Biden's economic advisor. And Joe Biden, you know, essentially had the shtick, if you will, of being the working man's guy, working person's guy, and Scranton, Pennsylvania, understanding that work mattered, that the hollowing out of the middle class had been horrible, while he was at the table with people that just didn't really give much of a damn about the hollowing out of the middle class or of manufacturing or of trade imbalances and economic imbalances that had built in the country. And that was the kind of, you know, neoliberal crowd, very kind of New York finance, you know, oriented crowd that played out after the TARP legislation. I remember talking to George about this. And at that moment, Joe Biden was on the right side of the aisle with this, but no one knew it. I mean, no one knew it. I mean, I wrote about these debates at that time. And I even shared with Vice President Biden in some of my conversations with him later about INET's work, and particularly the outcome of that conference, one of the early conferences at King's College in Cambridge, and what George had talked about these economic moments like the 08-09 financial crisis, creating warps and perversions in governance and in society. And we may be living through that right now in the United States, but I don't want to go all the way there, but we may be seeing something along those lines.
Well, I think of it in two contexts. The first of which is when Franklin Roosevelt was named president. People thought of him as a silver spoon in the mouth kind of elite guy, and nobody expected him to embrace what came to be called the New Deal, or to say, I welcome their hatred about financial and industrial oligarchs who despise the changes he was bringing forward. And so at some level, though he had an interesting crowd of people, Jesse Jones, Rex Tugwell, and others, Harold Ickes, that, how would I say, as a team rose to the challenge conceptually, I wouldn't write off the next president having, if it were in this case, Biden and Harris as the ticket, feeling compelled to do something bigger than business as usual. And maybe those echoes of that common man that you cite would come to the fore. On the other side of that pendulum, I hear many people say that Donald Trump did not come from Mars. The diseases of despair related to austere state and local budgets, globalization displacing particularly manufacturing jobs, all kinds of concerns and anxiety now and in the future about automation and the future of work. And in that despair, the meritocracy, as Michael Sandel talks about it, had a certain tyranny, and there was a caution, a self-satisfaction, maybe a deference to money in politics, and that Donald Trump, whose bumper sticker or his kind of campaign slogan is, the system is rigged, knocked down 15 Republicans before beating Hillary Clinton, And those people say, what are the Democrats going to do different? Where are they going to go that rises to the occasion, understanding that the despair that led to Trump and the kind of nationalistic reaction to globalization and other things had some basis and is what you might call is vital and alive, that despair is in the bloodstream of now.
You know, I think you frame it so well. And when you think about other administrations, so I think about a prospective Joe Biden administration, who are the economic advisors going to be? Are they going to be the heirs to Tim Geithner and Larry Summers? Or are they going to be folks that have been, you know, more closely aligned with the Jared Bernsteins or others that have been looking at those people that have been demeaned and left behind and harmed badly by the economic equation that we've had and the collapse of the social contract for middle class Americans? And, you know, and so when you kind of make this, you know, interesting comment about there, I would say and posit that there's a great possibility that just like Bill Clinton, just like Barack Obama, Joe Biden could mean well. He could even sound empathetic with those people that are suffering and struggling below, but that his brain trust continues to be captured by those, you know, out of, you know, Yale and Harvard Business School and others that represent a certain kind of economic ethic, if you will, that doesn't take these folks seriously. And I think that is a real challenge for Joe Biden. You know, look, Joe Biden, I like Joe Biden. We can get into that in a little bit if you like. Joe Biden is a senator from Delaware. Delaware is a credit card state. Guess who helped pass the legislation that made it harder for average Americans to declare bankruptcy and walk away from horrible debts that had been, you know, both through their own purchasing, but through their behavior? It was Joe Biden. Joe Biden protected the credit card industry, which is one of the villains in this story, right? But you know, he can still talk about Scranton. He can still talk about the average working class. In 2016, I did an interview with then Vice President Biden about the Hillary race and with Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And he said something very powerful that resonated with me, which is that the Democratic Party had become a party of snobs. And that had to change, that the Democratic Party could not come back until it wrestled with its soul and understand it had become a bastion for elite liberals. And I think you saw Donald Trump, as you just very accurately described, came out of that despair, came out of those feelings of frustration with what America had become and the way people felt screwed in so many different ways. I'll tell you a story. I did a really weird thing once where I went onto the website where you can have genetic testing. I'm somewhat, you know, fascinated by genealogy and, you know, DNA and all this. So I went on the site 23andMe, and you can find all these people that you are allegedly, well, that you are blood related to, that I don't know, second cousins, third cousins, fourth cousins. I came from an Air Force family, so I never really knew any of my broader relatives. So I contacted, you know, about 150 of them by email. Their emails are there, and said, hey, I'm Steve Clemens. I'm on MSNBC a lot. I would love to find a number of you that I could anonymously poll during the election. And just by the knowing the nature of my family, I knew most of them would be, you know, from Wisconsin, from Texas, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Kentucky. That's just where the big pockets were. And so it would be a fascinating kind of journey into my family, even though I didn't know them, and where their head was with regards to the race between Hillary Clinton and this. And most of my family, one thing is true, are military families who for generations, their antecedents had served in wars and conflicts. And so they felt they had given to the country. So about 90, so I got 100 of them to agree. 90 out of the 100 ended up voting for President Trump. 10 voted for Hillary Clinton. And it showed me something as we built up to this election of a disregard that the Clinton camp had missed and misunderstood that there were people that had felt they had given blood and life and sacrificed the country, but they weren't connecting to her, and that he was reaching something in them. because they did feel screwed by the 2008-2009 financial crisis. They did feel that they had fought the Cold War, but China had won, and that their jobs had been shipped away and shipped off. And after they had come home from service and had all sorts of problems, the job base wasn't there for them. So it was a living, breathing embodiment, if you will, of that frustration out there. I've gone back recently and emailed this same pool of folks, and it's right now about 75. There's been a small slippage. 75 of the 100 still support Trump. About 25 are in the Biden or not yet sure category. So there's been a little slippage with what's happened. But it's an interesting insight into the fact that there are real people connected to these economic choices that are made at the highest levels of government. And for too long, I think that, you know, many administrations, both Republican and Democrat, essentially chose an economic path that sold out those people in their interest and chose a form of globalization that was very brutal. There are things they could have done, I think, that we need to go back and look at that would have helped arm and equip and give people assets and tools to survive in a more turbocharged economy. But nobody has credibly done that. And I think the next president of the United States, if in this case, he wants to survive and do something for the country, is going to have to think about what is the real package of support and what is the social contract for American workers and American citizens need to be, because they're not all going to be workers. We can't employ everybody in the way the economy is going with technological change. So that's a quick insight into, I think, what you just laid out so beautifully.
I think, Steve, some of the guests or listeners on this podcast have heard me say before, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan. I was doing a conference for INET on race and inequality 3 days after that presidential election. On election day, it was raining in Detroit. I flew in, was supposed to be doing some photography of street art for backgrounds for the panels. And I ended up talking to a number of people and then going to a party that night. One of the gentlemen I talked to was a security guard who my father had known. And he was African-American. And I said to him, Ulysses, what do you think about the election? He said, well, Mr. Johnson, when there is nothing on the menu people want to eat, they don't come to the restaurant. And I looked at him and he said, the Clinton family did NAFTA, criminal justice reform, welfare reform, and the Obama administration did the restructuring of the auto industry, but they allowed all the white-collar service people to keep their jobs and plants to be built in Mexico and China with some of the money. It was like, I felt like I was talking to a political economic scholar of the highest level. He was so lucid. Bam, right on top of it. That night, I went to a party with seven people I'd gone to high school with. They were all CPA, JD, MD, MBAs. And those seven people, six of seven voted for Trump. And I asked them why. And they said, well, right after he got the nomination, he came to Michigan. Clinton didn't come to Michigan after she lost to Bernie. He came to Michigan and he went to the Detroit Economic Club and he scolded the management for losing so many American jobs. And they kind of looked at me, knowing where I was and where my wife was in a different place. And he said, this one fellow, a physician who's a very close friend of mine, he says, Rob, you left here and your family's prospered, but we all stayed in Michigan and we've never dug out of the hole, and the Democratic Party plays no role in helping us get out of the hole. They didn't view Trump as a Republican. They viewed him as somebody who outed the rigged system. And these were people who all had formidable educations, grew up in a wealthy suburb, etc. But they wanted no part of another, what you might call, dance step with the traditional neoliberal Democratic Party.
Well, I think, you know, that echoes through. I think the real question is right now is that 4 years after they made that decision, do they feel as if this guy has delivered on that? And I think he's delivered chaos, but I don't think he's delivered any form of real correction when it comes to, you know, solving problems of inequality, solving problems of racial injustice. You look across the board, to me, all of these, you know, tension points have become aggravated and have worsened. But maybe there's an opportunity there. Maybe in this chaos, this cauldron, as you described it, there is an opportunity, you know, for smart policymakers and well-meaning people of both parties to begin thinking a bit differently about what are going to be a new, you know, the new pieces of a social contract that works. How do you make education truly continuous and give people the resources, money, and support so it's not tapping them? How do you get away from crushing student debt, which has reached astronomical levels out there? How do you get out of this winner-takes-all system where people, based on who they're related to or their family or which zip code they're in, you know, have a fast track to success and others don't? This may be that moment. I don't think the Democrats come packaged with the answers either. I think they've been shocked because they did become. What's interesting is, you and I both know President Clinton, and President Clinton, I used to tell people Bill Clinton-style globalization was, you know, whatever's good for the multinational is good for America. That it was high trust globalization. It was interconnectedness. It was the era that we were connecting us, you know, with data and connectivity and the digital world, and ideas and institution and people and money were flowing more frictionlessly across borders. Well, today we have high fear globalization. Borders are back. Fear is back. People are worried. There's more of a zero-sum game, you know, out there. And you can see this in the posture of a lot of different countries. And so, you know, I think when you look at that, and when you look at the, you know, George W. Bush, you know, was not a defender of that style of globalization from Clinton. His best friends were baseball franchise owners and oil men. And that's a very different kind of, you know, orientation. But now we're at something where maybe the Trump disruption factor has knocked down the expectations and the strength of a kind of, you know, neoliberal control over this conversation, that it gives an opportunity for others to come out where Donald Trump doesn't have the ideas. He has been a wrecking ball. And in this, maybe if Biden comes in, or maybe in a second Trump administration, who knows, that, you know, these different ways to look at basic income, or looking at, you know, the ending some of the absurd corporate CEO compensation schemes we see out there, carried into you go through, and there's just, it's such a stacked deck. Those people who feel that it is a rigged system, well, it is a rigged system. It's a rigged system in favor of a very few and the very rich. And this needs to be reorganized and smashed. And what's, I think, interesting is that Donald Trump has smashed part of it, not all of it. He's still protecting a lot of the very wealthy out there. But I think it's an interesting opportunity if the pendulum were to swing. I don't know if Joe Biden and his team are going to be that crowd or not. I hope they are. But I think we should be talking openly and bluntly about what the terms are out there to get the economy back into a place where it can actually benefit people across the board and not just a tiny percentage at the top.
Well, I think the way I've often put it, Steve, is that Trump's diagnosis was on target, but his prescriptions look like a seduce and abandon. And yet the Democrats appear to me also to have been extremely timid. So when I see both sides with an inflamed, despondent public avoiding issues, it leads me to think that there are what I might call systemic structural issues that make it very hard for an elected official to represent a broad base of society, because in essence, they need so much money to get reelected, and first you got to survive before you can do policy. But I'm concerned that we have what some call a plutocratic corporate regime that's in many ways bipartisan. And it's not just what you might call discretionary immoral behavior on the part of elected officials. It's a survival tactic given the structural issues that are before us.
Well, I think that that's right. It's hard to argue with that when you look at the, you know, I would call it the spinelessness of a lot of major politicians. But I think, yeah, that working to remain in office, stay elected, but not do the great things of the moment that need to be done. And so there is a deficit, if you will, in people that are thinking and acting more boldly. Now, I think there are exceptions. You know, I've been, I'm not a big fan of assault rifles all over the country and, you know, not having background checks. And I'm horrified by the gun violence in the country. And, you know, Senator Chris Murphy has written a book called The Violence Inside Us. I highly recommend people read it. I read it, you know, went in. But Chris Murphy, you know, Chris Murphy is not God's gift on all things. I don't agree with him on all things. But he does really make an interesting, compelling case that very few people, I mean, he was, you know, called by Lawrence O'Donnell, you know, a kind of relatively safe guy that had moved from the House, that had, you know, done all the right things in getting into Congress, then had become a senator, you know, and he was, you know, a standout, but kind of bland, kind of risk averse, didn't put himself on the line on anything. And then he went down to the floor of the Senate and he filibustered along with Cory Booker and others after Sandy Hook and after the murder of so many children and other gun incidents and whatnot. But he wrote about this fascinating book. I'm fascinated by it because Chris Murphy is basically declaring on this issue, he is going to do whatever it takes and sacrifice reputation and position to do that. I would like to see senators or cabinet members or other leaders in society come out and say, fixing inequality is something that we're willing to sacrifice position and status and take risks around, because the staggering impact on people's lives. You know, you go to Baltimore, greater Baltimore area. Baltimore's been in the news a lot lately because of the conventions. But there are areas in greater Baltimore area, you go across a line and there are 20 years difference in age, in life expectancy between just small distances in Baltimore. And that has everything to do with jobs, you know, disinvestment, you know, and basically, you know, the bias and systemic racism that was built up in our policies. And how do you wake up after that nightmare? It's going to take time, investment, patience, frustration, but you've got to be in to do it. And it's going to require, you know, incredible thinking, strategic decisions, lots of resources, and people risking themselves around that. And so I think what you just said about that complicated equation of people worried more about staying in office and they've become this plutocratic oligarchy at the top. I think you need to follow. We need to kind of applaud people like Murphy on guns in this case, but look for people that are able to do that and bring people along with them to rethink the social contract in America and our economic equation and how it's got to work.
So let's back up. We've gotten out into the politics and the challenge that's before us, but let's go into the what I'll call diagnostic manual that an INET aficionado might adopt. We've got issues of climate, issues you've talked about, inequality, criminal justice and prison industrial system, environmental challenges, financialization, automation in the future of work and displacement of jobs, globalization, where in many respects, a person who's a political representative might be right by telling the people who elected him to diminish their demands so that capital and technology with wings don't get up and fly to another country and leave them with nothing. But they look like they're working for the other side. So you have many, many different, how would I say, candidates, but I'm curious, Steve, what are the things that you think, how would I say, with your magnifying glass and the diagnostic manual, are on the front burner? What should someone in the first 100 days of the next administration be, how would I say, advocating for with no holds barred?
Well, I wish I could just sign up for everything you just said and just say all of the above. It's such a great list of what ought to be the defining, you know, questions and issues we have to solve. And you have that list in front of you. So yeah, sign me up on all of that. But I think, you know, if I were to, you know, talk about, you know, an administration that came in sensing that this was a true crisis and that it needed a strategic leap out of the current circumstances, that means boldness. You know, I would find ways to, it would shock the markets, but what the hell? I would write off a ton of student debt. I would give people that are carrying a lot of other debt the, you know, and still who have been underwater from the 08-09 financial crisis, and I would say underwater from impacts of the COVID crisis, and I would create conditions that it would allow those folks to find ways to stay. I mean, I worry right now of just keeping people in their homes. So I would look at the way in which you can use new instruments out there to lighten the debt load and disappear some of the debt load for Americans and have the government take that, because I think it gives an opportunity to restart. So we're not playing at the fringe. That's one thing I would do. The second thing I would do is I would look at how to, when it comes to the equation, particularly with work, because technology is racing. You know, I feel like we're in an interesting moment when it comes to technological change, which is having a job impact. But we have two things simultaneously going on in this country. One is technological change and major leaps forward in just about every arena that you can think of. But if Galileo were to be resurrected and come back today, I think he would be found guilty in this environment. So there's an anti-science combined with technology, you know, changing where, and how do you get that right? Well, I think you've got to find a way to help those people who are going to become victims of automation, AI, Internet of Things, big data, particularly those people that are that have lower quality or no degrees. You know, I think we need to use this as a moment to rewire our education and credentialing system in this country and create more nimble and cost-free credentialing systems for people to be quickly trained. You know, we all pretend, those that have gone off to four-year universities or done advanced degrees, that, you know, we can handle anything, that we're smart enough, we learn critical thinking, we can just come along. But the bottom line is, the world is changing so rapidly, we all need to have some form and track for continuous education. And we do not have that ethic in this country, and it's costing us in a big way. I look at it as sort of the new highway, right? The highways that Eisenhower did. We need to have a new ethic built into our system across our educational platforms, and do it in a way that gives people, I mean, my brother was laid off three times in the high tech area. He went into, you know, the medical field. He now works on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. He's loved where he does, but he works in elder care facilities and he's basically a nurse. But it cost him $75,000 to do that, to retrain from being, you know, a tech guy into this other. People can't do that. You know, of course, his family helped him achieve that. But, you know, when you look at the costs that we force on people that are trying to retain after they've been their jobs, you know, he trained his Indian successor. So he was a classic case of this. And I think we need to fix that dimension. You know, and I would also say that, this is more of a macro thing, and perhaps it's a bit in the clouds. But I remember when I worked for Senator Jeff Bingaman in the 1990s and then Clyde Prestowitz at the Economic Strategy Institute, both of these people were trying to blow the whistle on kind of manic globalization, rushing China too quickly into large institutions without thinking about what the consequences were, looking at what were going to be the impact on, you know, various kinds of industries, looking at the large structural imbalances then with Japan, but building with China. You know, Bingaman got Clinton to set up a commission that looked at these issues. And of course, they put a Goldman Sachs guy in as chairing it and kind of, you know, blew the original purpose of it. But you know, people like Bob Lighthizer, who were in the steel industry, we brought back those issues of trade imbalance and their impact from 20 years ago. And we are now talking about commodities stupidly, like steel, soybean, you know, meat, and whatnot, in terms of China trade and with our other trading partners, when we really need to be looking at, I think, broader questions of how can you build in both a smart industrial policy in this country that seeds back into the United States industries that matter, like AI, like various advanced technologies that I think are, you know, sieving away to other countries. But you need to connect U.S. jobs, U.S. R&D. You have to create ecosystems in this country of science, partnerships with university companies that help create opportunities for the people, you know, that are here, and even foreign talent, international talent that's brought into the United States. You've got to create those environments. We haven't tended these well, and those R&D centers are going abroad, and I worry about the large macro consequences of that down the road. So that would be another thing that I would put in the agenda. There's probably a lot more on climate that I would add, but I think the climate picture is one. You know, there's Ernie Moniz has a great new group that he heads called the Energy Futures Initiative. And the Moniz, of course, who was the former Secretary of Energy and an MIT nuclear physicist, says we're going to have to kind of look at new strategic leaps in infrastructure. How can we connect advances in our infrastructure, particularly our grids in energy and new forms of cleaner energy, to a job base? We're going to have to think like Roosevelt did in how to do a kind of WPA style set of partnerships with, you know, workers that are displaced by technology, but bring them and train them and connect them to the new massive national infrastructure projects that help us achieve a cleaner nation, that help us achieve our climate targets, and that create greater models and examples of sustainability. And that's a lot. But right, you know, the list that you laid out is so big and so robust, in part because of the neglect and to some degree the deregulation mania of the Trump administration. This is something we have major differences, where Trump has recklessly deregulated in areas, harmed the environment, harmed the ability of people to kind of survive and navigate this system, both with their education, with their assets, whatnot. And I think we've got to come back and take a quick look at all of that and put back in place. I mean, we've deregulated in ways that even even in the oil and fossil fuel sector, which isn't often applauded, they feel that Trump has gone way too far, that they had achieved efficiencies and, you know, we're on a track. And I think we need to go back and look at all of that within the first 100 days. So, I mean, sorry to get so long winded, but it's a great question. And you had a long list.
I'm running down a track with my imagination listening to you. One of the things that you talked about was U.S. and China. You mentioned Bob Lighthizer and others, who I remember when I worked with Pete Domenici, I had some small association with and had a lot of respect for him. But right now, I've just made a podcast with Dean Baker just a few days ago. He's got a piece on Counterpunch that is all about essentially U.S., China, and the new Cold Warriors. And what he says is our political economy is, how would I say, misrepresentative. So we'll fight over intellectual property rights. We'll fight to protect the pharmaceutical industry when it might be better for our American people to have a competition where a vaccine comes sooner and better from somewhere else. But his point is, we sat and we watched 3.5 million manufacturing jobs get lost to a China-led globalization. We provided no transitional or adjustment assistance. We did things like allowed affluent people to keep their money offshore and defer, if not avoid, paying taxes. We didn't put back together the public school system and the trade adjustment assistance, the retraining, the kind of things like you talked about what your brother went through. And what Dean is essentially saying is we got flattened, and the despair of the broad range of the public that got flattened is not going to be reversed by fighting on behalf of tech and pharmaceuticals and the movie industry to protect what you might call their rents, their patents, their control, and reduce competition. I thought it was a fascinating offering at this juncture.
I think Dean Baker is one of the great souls of you know, modern economics, and he sort of thinks ahead, and he thinks, you know, he thinks passionately and powerfully, sometimes too intensely for even me. But I really love, and I always take Dean Baker seriously, and I think what he is saying makes a lot of sense. And you know, whereas I worry right now, you know, I always worry about how we slip from a concocted economic collision, because I don't believe Donald Trump really cares that much about the China side. There's so many moments of hypocrisy in this administration and how it deals with different challenges. But let's say that, you know, the imbalance, you know, the issue is China is not a liberal nation. It is an autocratic nation. It is, you know, one that has essentially used market forces, but maintains a command control at the top. And it is a mercantilist nation. And the size, I mean, you know, you and I, Clyde Prestowitz, Chalmers Johnson, many of us have been talking about, you know, China as a larger Japan, that if we didn't correct these imbalances and behaviors at a certain point, Jim Mann, who wrote Beijing Jeep, I mean, so we've been writing about this problem for years. I'll tell you, you know, when I worked for Bingaman, and again, in the 1990s, we had Sandia National Weapons Laboratory in New Mexico, and we had cooperative research and development agreements with companies like Intel and General Motors and, you know, large firms. And, you know, the head of GM China, a guy named Rudy Schles, you know, was funding the largest CRADA, the largest, cooperative research and development grant, you know, with Sandia Labs to take tech. He was visibly said on the record to take technology from the partnership, from the taxpayer supported national security lab, and pump it into our production facilities in China. And I was astonished. And I said, really? Why would you do that? Because he said, if we don't do that, and he said, you're going to end up with facilities that are more advanced in the United States. I said, yes, but if we don't do that, we won't be there in 30 years. So, you listen to these kinds of moments and say, you know what, we do need to rebalance our relationship with China. But that doesn't make China the boogeyman on all the, it's been the financialization approach and the failure to look at these micro cases and the failure to have what I would consider to be have a better and smarter, I'll say it out loud, industrial policy. You know, it's very funny. You couldn't say industrial policy in the 2008-2009 financial crisis when Steve Rattner, who's now on Morning Joe all the time with his charts, and was partly in charge of, you know, trying to save the auto sector, he couldn't say the words industrial policy. Now, industrial policy is, you know, the thing of the moment. You know, Donald Trump, they're not doing it, but they talk about it a lot. And I think what, you know, it enables us to begin looking at the fact that, to Dean Baker's point, I don't want to have a thing about keeping, you know, feather bedding for the pharmaceutical industry or feather bedding, you know, for Hollywood. We need, you know, these are rent seekers that are manipulating the political establishment to, you know, achieve the ends they want. That's not a sane and rational, coherent economic policy for the country. And I think that's where you get back into kind of looking at, okay, are we being smart with our universities in the way we're keeping, you know, global talent from coming in? No, we should want that global talent in this country. We should be trying to keep it in this country, seeding businesses, engaged in technology, building jobs, you know, taking risks, creating, you know, a field of entrepreneurship for those that would do that. But we're kind of, you know, I think in my book, kicking our, you know, we're king of the hill and kicking our hill down, as a friend of mine once said. But I think that there are lots of things that we could do that are smarter. You mentioned Bob Lighthizer, whom we both know, who is, you know, along with Alan Wolf, you know, the two of them were sort of the kings of the legal representatives for the steel industry. I can't believe we think steel industry is necessarily a major part of America's future, but we're still debating those kinds of politics. And I think we need to upgrade that and begin looking at the broader questions of how do you not fall into the Dean Baker trap that he fears, that we begin looking more holistically at how we create rich and vibrant environments of firms that are technologically adept with, you know, government financing and support, that are staying here and beating the global competition, you know, on their own terms, is something I wish we were doing. But a lot of that was sold out, and it's easier for me to say it than to do it. But that would be a key piece of my policy if I were advising the President of the United States.
Well, you probably recall Peter Goodman, who used to work with the Huffington Post, now the New York Times, based in London. Peter wrote a story, I believe it was in January of 2019, called We Love the Robots. And shortly thereafter, Lev Progrotsky, who was ran the U.S. consulate in New York, asked me to join a meeting with a bunch of Swedish economists where they said, in the old days, Europe was considered sclerotic because we protected too many things, whereas America was kind of hard-hitting, bang, shift, reallocate to a different sector, and that was considered the vibrant growth model. They went on to say to me that the backlash given pervasive automation, financialization, globalization, and what have you, was stalling America out. And it wasn't going to be at the vanguard of the next phase of growth and dynamism. And what they essentially said in the article, and which they echoed in the conversation with me, was we don't protect jobs. We protect people, education, pension, health care, our children's education, daycare. So we love the robots because they change what economists call the production possibility frontier. But we know that as members of society, those gains will be shared, will be distributed, and things won't break down. Things will get better. That faith in governance, that faith in transfers, in adjustment assistance, in continuing education, and being part of vitality is something those Swedish economists think in this next phase will be the growth model. And I'll echo, when I meet with Chinese leaders, they often say to me, we aren't the size of Tonga. We are a huge country, over four times the size of the United States population-wise. Integrating us globally was going to put strain on the United States, but we, meaning the Chinese leadership, have lots of things to work on after China 2025 and questions of protection and intellectual property that they were acknowledging. But they said the one thing we can't do is drew proper retraining and adjustment assistance within America. So given your ideology of free trade makes everyone better off and no one necessarily worse off, can't be realized without those transfers and adjustment assistance. And as a result, President Trump is demonizing us, and we had no power to affect those outcomes. Those are the responsibility of the American government, and that's where the problem lies.
Right. You know, Rob, I'll say, I mean, Lev Progrotsky and this crowd, I mean, they're some of the most wonderful thinkers and out-of-the-box thinkers, and it's a great model to look at. But in 1997, I drafted something that was called the Senate Democratic High Wage Task Force Report called Scrambling to Pay the Bills. And in this, there were more than 80 different initiatives. And again, this is 1990s, right? So we're in the IT boom. Bill Clinton's administration did not want to hear very much about, you know, what do we do for people that are being left behind? Because you saw this bubble building in the IT area. You saw, you know, people, you know, through stock trades and whatnot, capital gains, you know, skyrocketing. You saw revenues to states. We knew it was unsustainable, and we knew there was a real problem out there. And we saw people being ripped off. And again, to go back to that comment that you made, that so many people feel like the system is rigged, and that's what Donald Trump took advantage of. Well, it was, because people were forced to, you know, be the least nimble part of the equation. Capital could be nimble and unfettered. Alan Greenspan, Larry Summers didn't want to consider anything like a Tobin tax. You know, we had suggested a kind of small transaction tax to invest in people's ongoing continuous education, or to reward companies, give companies a lower tax rate if they were reinvesting in R&D in their company here in the United States, and looking at the R&D side, and looking at education, pension portability, health pensions in a different way, reverse match in pensions. All the things you could do to help and equip workers to make their own choices and to surf, you know, the more turbulent waves of the economy, but to surf it more successfully. And they did nothing. We wrote the report. Nothing happened at all along those lines for many, many years. And it shows that we're paying a price today that we began and we actually thought about in the bowels of, you know, the legislative branch of government, you know, along the lines that Leif Pagrotsky and the Swedish economists are doing, you know, in terms of how you stand by your people in this economy. But you don't become anti-growth. You don't look. You look at the way in which you give them the tools and assets to do it. That is the secret sauce of a successful society, a successful economy. And we didn't do it. We purposely didn't do it. And at that time, it was a Democratic administration who didn't do it. Now we're with a Republican one who's not doing it.
Well, with the healthcare crisis that's upon us, I'm always quite taken aback when I look at OECD numbers, the relatively advanced economies, and see the United States is at the bottom of that chart. World Health Organization ranks us 38th in the world in terms of quality of healthcare. But at the cost of healthcare per capita, we're at the top of that chart and almost double some of the countries per capita expense on healthcare, and some of those that pay half as much are in the top 10 in performance. So I guess I'm looking at healthcare now through the lens of the pandemic, where your health doesn't just matter to you, your health can matter to me too. And I'm looking at a systemic function, and I'm looking at the way that you described at the outset of this conversation, how inequality of income, wealth, some things related to race or gender discrimination, affect outcomes, financial outcomes, health outcomes, employment security. But when I look at the pandemic, rich people need less affluent people to have good health care to diminish the propagation of something that can reach back and affect them and their loved ones. And I don't know, Steve, how we can get out of what I'll call fantasy individualism and begin to understand that freedom isn't just to do what you want. It's also related to freedom from intrusion by the excesses of others or the irresponsibility of others. Are we in a place where this experience of the pandemic can shake us deeply enough to come out of what I call a rather shallow ideological conviction that is doing a great deal of harm?
I hope so, but you know, I guess I become jaded, and I was hopeful after, you know, any number of major gun incidents out there where so many innocent people were killed that maybe gun legislation would pass. I began to get interviewed with people, you know, is this the moment, the inflection point, will things change? And I would cynically say no, and you could see the TV host just grimacing that I said that, but I'm a realist. I'm a realist. I don't build my either my analysis, my diagnostics around hope. I mean, I have aspirations, but you've got to read it as it is. And right now, the political equation has to change. The value of ideas and expertise on these issues has to change. The winners and losers, you know, in terms of those that are thinking about these economic questions need to change. INET needs to ascend. And some of those who have been more dominant and have been more have infected this process more need to lose. And I guess when it comes to issues of inequality and what we've seen after George Floyd's murder, Breonna Taylor's, Ahmaud Arbery, and so many others, and the protests around the nation, I've interviewed people like Martin Luther King III and Angela Davis, who all themselves say they think this might be a moment where things would change. You know, Cornel West, the same thing. He said, maybe this is a moment where we can see across you know, our brothers and sisters, in his words, you know, a commitment to change. All I'll say is it will come in two parts. It will come because so many people are frustrated that there is a kind of spontaneous moment where folks, that will put pressure on the elites, on folks that it's not a revolution. It's just, you'll know it when you feel it. It'll be a shock. And it will basically send a signal, you know, to the folks we know in Washington, the folks we know in state capitals, that they've got to rejigger the social contract. They're going to have to tax the rich, and they're going to have to find a smart way to redistribute resources and opportunity to those people on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum.
Yeah, who have not had a fair chance. I think you're exactly right. By the way, I want to recommend a book to you and our listeners. There's a gentleman named Timothy Snyder who's written about tyranny in the past. I believe he's at Yale University. Has a new book called Our Malady: Lessons in Liberty from a Hospital Diary. And it's a very, I'm a little bit less than halfway through it, but it's a very powerful exploration of what I will call the commodification of healthcare as distinct from it being a basic human right, and how it nearly cost him his life. I think we have to go deep now. I think that deep Wow. ethical and philosophical exploration is called for. The prevailing ideology feels shallow, timid, maybe strident, not timid. I think we need more critical discourse. We need a bigger fight.
Yeah. Well, what I would say, we need discourse, I'll say this, in probably just in closing, I'll tell you that, I'm a student, I look at myself as a student, as an addict of history and history books, and looking at moments of complete chaos, of breakdown, of moment when everything has come apart, and the need for institution building, the need for, writing new social contracts, whether it was the Great Depression or whether it was after World War II, that we have both domestically and internationally come to those moments where we've had smart people rise to the top and create new terms of trade, new ways to think about things. I'm hoping that this time is that, because it feels as if too much is boiling at the same time. When you look at climate, you look at inequality, you look at race, you look at trade, you look at the global situation, you look at the domestic, the fact that we have two tribes or more living in America with very different, very different forms of gravity, operating in each bubble. And I think that this is a moment for the INET type thinkers in the world to fill that void with smarter intellectual and policy infrastructure than we've had. And that gives me some hope and optimism about the time we're in.
Well, Steve, I guess with my Detroit roots, I always reach back to Marvin Gaye. And I love his third verse of What's Going On, where he says, "We've got to find a way to bring some understanding here today."
Yeah.
And I think
that's a great line.
That you are one of those warriors for good. You mentioned Dean Baker, but you stand right up in the front row. I encourage everybody to follow your writings on the Hill and beyond. But how would I say? There's a lot to focus on. There's a lot to do. And you're right in the middle of where the transition, where the persuasion, where the change of conventional wisdom has to unfold for us to get to a better place. We can't do economics without politics. They are inseparable. And you're quite lucid, quite courageous, and quite insightful at that intersection. And I'm grateful for all that you do.
Well, I'm grateful, Rob, and you've been leading us there, and it's been great to be both a friend of yours and a friend of INET's these many years. So thank you for this opportunity today.
So I'm gonna go right to it. I want to book you to do a follow up right after the election when we know who the next president is, and we'll team together, pretend we're advisors of the next president, and map out. So we can start doing our homework right now, and some of those things
that'd be fantastic.
Today. But I will be calling you for an early November second episode.
All right, my friend, you have a deal.
All righty. Thanks for today, and we'll see you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Rob.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.